Iran rejects the U.S. top diplomat's comments about the ongoing talks to revive the JCPOA, saying the deadlines announced by Washington are fabricated. North Korea reportedly test fires more ballistic missiles amid tensions following the latest U.S. sanctions on the country. And the so-called Partygate scandal involving British Prime Minister Johnson deepens amid growing calls for his resignation. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The United States has warned that time is running out for Iran to revive the 2015 agreement. Now, Iran's foreign ministry says that the deadlines announced by Washington are all fabricated.
Regarding some fabricated deadlines, I have to tell you that the current U.S. president, his foreign policy team, his negotiators in Vienna know that if JCPOA is alive today, that's because of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the U.S.
Speaking of the U.S. adopting a Plan B in case the talks fail, Khatibzadeh urged Washington to focus on Plan A and speed up efforts to salvage the JCPOA. The spokesman urged the United States to stop what it called its bullying behavior and instead fulfill its international obligations. Now, those comments came as the eighth round of talks aimed at reviving the accord is underway in the Austrian capital. The head of the Iranian delegation, Ali Bakhrakani, and other parties to the deal are now back to the negotiating table after consultations with their capitals to discuss the related issues. Iran and China have announced the implementation of a 25-year collaboration agreement aimed at strengthening bilateral economic and political ties. Now, the sweeping agreement is a sign of Iran's pivot on the east in defiance of the U.S. that has apparently showed its discontent by slapping sanctions on Iran.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world in the Middle East and globally.
Now, Iran's growing ties with China are part of the Islamic Republic's look to the East policy. That also involves bringing together other U.S. adversaries like Russia, which Iran also has a long-term deal with. Hostile U.S. policies, including sanctions, have been a major reason for countries like Russia and China and Iran to get closer. And to soften the blow of the sanctions, these countries are all moving toward de-dollarization.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an East-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries, and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these, and they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran's.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran
One of the icons of popular resistance in the occupied West Bank has died after being critically wounded by Israeli forces. Sheikh Soleiman Al-Hathlin was run over by a vehicle belonging to Israeli forces earlier this month. The incident took place in the village of Al-Khair, south of West Bank. Hathlin's brother says that he was deliberately targeted. The 65-year-old activist was a staunch opponent of Israeli settlement activities and occupation in the Palestinian territories. Some 700,000 Israelis live in settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The settlements are illegal under international law, with several UN Security Council resolutions condemning such construction activities. Meantime, the Israeli aggression against Palestinians comes in a variety of forms and takes on new shapes from time to time. Most recently, Israeli bulldozers under heavy security protection from the army is stormed into a Bedouin Palestinian village, all in the name of a tree planting project. But that, as expected, drew a fierce reaction from local residents and plunged the region into a fresh escalation. Let's take a closer look.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Negev Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land. These are our villages. We've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
South Korea and Japan say that the North has conducted another weapons test, firing projectiles eastward. The two countries say that North Korea fired two suspected short-range ballistic missiles from Sanan Airfield in Pyongyang. This is North Korea's fourth launch in less than 2 weeks, including test firing two hypersonic missiles. On Wednesday, the U.S. imposed new sanctions on Pyongyang. North Korea says its recent missile tests are an exercise of its right to self-defense in the face of potential regional threats. It says that the U.S. is intentionally escalating the situation. The so-called Partygate scandal deepening in the U.K. as reports emerge of yet another Downing Street gathering while COVID restrictions were in place. UK Daily The Mirror says that a farewell party was held for a government defense advisor in the run-up to Christmas 2020. Prime Minister Boris Johnson attended and gave his speech at the event, and that's the latest in a string of revelations about government staff attending parties during COVID lockdowns. Johnson already apologized for attending one such gathering that took place in the garden of his residence in May 2020. He reportedly was questioned as part of an internal inquiry. The revelations have caused a huge backlash, with the opposition and even some of the lawmakers in Johnson's own party calling for his resignation. However, UK media says that Johnson is trying to save his job by blaming and dismissing his aides. Now, Moscow says that the U.S. and NATO have overstepped its red lines by their gradual invasion into Ukraine.
NATO is a weapon of confrontation. And this weapon of confrontation with each year started to get closer and closer to our borders. We have seen the gradual invasion of NATO into Ukrainian territory with its infrastructure, with its instructors, with supplies of defensive and offensive weapons. That brought us to the red line. That brought us to the situation when we couldn't tolerate it anymore.
Now, the spokesman says that Western governments failed to fulfill their promise not to expand NATO eastward. Peskov says that's why Moscow wants relevant binding guarantees. The spokesman warned that NATO's expansion to former Soviet states bordering Russia is a real threat, both for the country and the whole European security structure. He also warned that Russia is ready to take counteractions in case NATO continues its deployments in Ukraine. Now, Peskov's comments came after the U.S. once again accused Russia of trying to invade Ukraine and threaten Moscow with sanctions.
what we have laid out is a very clear message to the Russians. And we've done so in concert and unison with our allies, that if they do further invade Ukraine, there will be severe economic consequences and a price to pay.
Jake Sullivan says that the U.S. and its allies will give an appropriate response that Moscow has confirmed to have been behind recent cyber attacks on Ukraine. On the other side, Russian officials demand written responses to security proposals they've offered to the U.S. and NATO. Moscow wants guarantees that NATO's eastward expansion will be stopped and that troops and military hardware will be removed from areas close to its borders. Russia also rejects the West's claims about its intentions to attack Ukraine, saying that the troop movement along its borders is to ensure its security in the face of NATO's advances. A winter storm combining high winds and snowfall sweeping through parts of the U.S. southeast, disrupting normal life. The storm left nearly 100,000 people without power due to falling trees and fences. Many roads and streets are coated with a treacherous frigid glaze. More than 2.5 centimeters of snow fell per hour in some parts of the states of North and South Carolina, as well as Georgia, Tennessee, and Virginia. Thousands of flights were canceled on Sunday. Conditions are expected to deteriorate further, especially in North Carolina. Parks and libraries were closed in the state on Sunday in some areas, and weather stations recorded wind gusts traveling at more than 80 kilometers per hour. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. One of the crowded places of Tehran, Shush Square. Tehran is a modern city, though we have to remember the fact that this city has been recognized as the capital of Iran since Qajarid era. Therefore, it's almost old. So, there are many buildings and old monuments in this city. Today, we are going to visit one of the old places of Tehran, Khanat Caravansaray. Khanat Caravansaray is the biggest in-town caravansaray of Tehran. To define simply, Caravansaray is a building that used to accommodate a caravan. These caravans include different goods and quadruped animals, which traveled from one city to another, so they needed a place for rest. A caravansaray has usually a big square or rectangular yard, as well as a tall, big entrance. Constructing caravansaray started booming in Safavid era. It was during this period that Shah Abbas I decided to reconstruct the Silk Road, and for doing so, he started building and repairing several caravansarays. Khanat Caravansaray was built at the end of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar dynasty. The area of Khanat Caravansaray in Tehran is about 10,500 square meters. This caravansaray has 70 chambers inside the yard, as well as four small markets behind these chambers. The height of Khanat Caravansaray's gate is 6 meters. It's made of Russian wood and has 40 studs on it. I am now near Khanat Caravansaray. This caravansaray was initially located in the suburb of Tehran, but after Tehran got extended, this caravansaray came to be inside the city. Let's go inside the caravansaray and see what's going on there. Oh my God, what a big, beautiful yard. It reminds me of Naqsh-e-Jahan Square in Isfahan. Though it's not that big, but it's as beautiful as it. Four turquoise-colored pools are situated in this yard in a symmetrical way. And the chambers are circling around this big yard. In front of each chamber, there is a small balcony which has a vault-like ceiling. The ceilings, which are made of bricks, are very beautiful. The architecture of this caravansaray is brickwork. This caravansaray has still kept its use. However, its today's use has nothing to do with its use in the past. Of course, there is no caravan or quadruped animal, but there are people who are busy buying goods, especially nuts and dried fruits, in the chambers of this caravansaray. Oh, look, there is a traditional restaurant with a great atmosphere here. People come here to eat and, of course, take a tour around the caravansaray. The smell of food is great. I may go to the restaurant to have lunch. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The end of Boris Johnson? That is a question that is being floated in UK politics and amongst Britons. The Prime Minister is facing the biggest challenge to his premiership as the Partygate scandal has snowballed into a political nightmare for him. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the Prime Minister has any magic tricks up his sleeve to save his position and whether his party can actually survive this blow, while the Labour Party's popularity has increased as a result. All to get the latest on this first, I'm going to cross on over to London and talk to our correspondent, Amina Taylor. Amina Taylor, what are we looking at here? I'm looking at front page headlines that does not bode well for the Prime Minister. I'm not too sure which one to ask you about as we're looking at all these different really harsh rhetoric coming from these headlines. You tell us what's standing out right now for Boris Johnson and then for the people there in the UK, how they feel about him.
Well, Kaveh, we're clearly in the containment section of this operation from the Conservative Party, because it was clear that the deny, 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 and then lie stage was proving to be ineffective. Once photos had been released of the latest party that was taking place during the May 2020 lockdown, this is after we'd already had news of the one in December, and then to just add misery on top of insult, on top of disbelief, this party that took place on the eve of Prince Philip's funeral. So with all of this in mind, I think what the Tories are trying to do here is to rally the troops, to go with the position that the Sue Gray inquiry, which is of course the civil servant who is in charge essentially of marking the government's homework here on this one, let's wait to see what she has to say and then we make a move. But if Keir Starmer is correct here, it is very difficult to see how the Prime Minister can say he did not break protocol. And if you break protocol and then you're found to have lied about it, it's very difficult to see how you can stay in your position. I think the only thing that is saving Boris Johnson from having to walk the political plank now is the fact that nobody with any real credibility wants the job as the head of the Tory party at the moment. Rishi Sunak is the man they're touting. He wouldn't want to touch this dirty basket right now. He'd want to wash his hands until the next election, then swoop in. And Labour, they know this as well, Kaveh.
Okay, and before I let you go, just very quickly, if you can, this Operation Save Big Dog, which points to points to government reshuffle, is that accurate? Is it true, or is it just rumors?
It is ludicrous, but I think the idea here is that Boris Johnson is a useful tool for them at the moment. There are still parts where he is liked, but they recognize that it would be electoral suicide for them to get rid of him now, especially with Labour ahead in the polls. So keep him in until we can get a guy and we can distance ourselves from this scandal.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Amina Taylor there, a correspondent from London. Thank you for the latest on this. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have John White, He's a writer and political analyst joining us from Edinburgh. Also joining us, Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from Belfast. Very well. Welcome to both of you. John White, let me first start with you. When I asked our correspondent about the latest, she went through the events, which may be, in a sense, overlooked by people who are not so familiar, because we're looking at an explosive set of events that happened one after the other regarding these numerous parties and the way that the government reacted to it, which then, if you take a line to the side of that, is filled with lies, it's filled with silence. Perhaps you can tell us how that does not bode well for the people who are in power, or maybe their days are numbered at this point.
Well, just like the US under Trump, under Johnson, Britain is in a post-truth scenario when it comes to its politics. Boris Johnson is a proven liar, he's a rogue, he's a man for whom integrity is a foreign land, and he seems quite astonishingly impervious to the extent of the anger of the British public over these revelations, which are coming fast and furious by the week of further parties that were taking place in and around Downing Street during lockdown. We're here now, there were regular Friday night wine nights among his staffers and people who work there and work with him closely in his office. So it is quite astonishing the extent, not only to which he seems impervious to the consequences of these actions during strict lockdown, when people up and down the UK were denied the right to be with loved ones on their deathbeds or be with loved ones for months and months on end because of the regulations and the rules that were passed by his government. And he was standing at the rostrum articulating the new regulations as he came in. People couldn't mix, they couldn't see family members, etc., etc. But the Tory party seems to be intent on circling the wagons. Operation Big Dog says it itself. If Al Capone did politics, he would be on the side of Boris Johnson. He doesn't care about public opinion. He thinks he can tough it out. He is a creature of entitlement and privilege. And you get to see how this story is going to run, because what he has done is he's managed to unite the UK media from left to right in anger and splenetic rage at the extent to which his government and people working for his government were flouting lockdown rules throughout 2020 and 2021.
Sure. Well, we're going to get into the way that Boris Johnson has conducted himself when it comes to politics. Some say that's his asset, but in this case, we're not sure about that. But Fra Hughes, I have to ask you this about how you have these parties, one after the other, to bring your booze party, which really then tick people off. I don't want to beat the events to a pulp here. But when it came to that party that was held the night before the funeral of Prince Philip, well, that also struck a nerve with many people there in Britain, especially when you have the picture of the Queen by herself to sit alone due to the coronavirus restrictions. Did that push this whole thing over the edge with that happening? And how badly or severely did that affect public opinion against Johnson?
Well, I think firstly we'll have to maybe acknowledge the fact that there appears to be a campaign to undermine Boris Johnson's premiership. The fact that these leaks are coming thick and fast, one after the other, it appears orchestrated to put pressure and mounting pressure onto Boris Johnson and his cabinet, with ongoing further allegations of these parties. I suppose when it comes to Prince Philip, a lot of the British people are monarchists. I mean, a lot of the tabloid media and a lot of people really from kind of when they're born into the British United Kingdom system are brought up to revere with adulation the royal family. So the fact that they were partying the night before the funeral of Prince Philip does indicate a kind of abject negation of responsibility by those in charge. I mean, normally that funeral would have been huge. The military display that would be attendant to the funeral, all the monarchy there in their regalia and their splendor, seeing off Prince Philip. I think it just proves that there is a genuine disconnect between those who run the country, those who see themselves as entitled, and the elite, the people who have been to the various public schools and the public school upbringing that they've had, these multi-millionaires who claim to be in touch with the common people.
I think the disregard shown by Boris Johnson and all those who attended maybe proves two things. One thing is, if it wasn't for the leak, we wouldn't know anything about this, and it would be just a continuation of Boris in power.
Who do you think is responsible for the leaks coming out? I mean, we know the first one. I mean, you're saying that there are successive leaks coming out at this pace that's somewhat not ordinary. But the way the government handled it is obviously also not professionally handled. So that's another aspect of this. But let's move on. And I'm sorry to jump in, because I'd like to move on to how there is now a call from within Johnson's party. John White, sixth conservative MP, calling for the prime minister to quit. We have estimated, based on our sources, 20 may have submitted letters to, I guess, what's called the 1922 committee, well short of the 54 needed. However, and you talked about Operation Save Big Dog. Is that Boris Johnson's way of trying to get out of this?
Well, we're waiting for the conclusions of Sue Gray, the civil servant who's been tasked with investigating the leaks, the parties, etc., which her conclusions are said to will be published at the end of next week. A lot of Tory MPs are following the line of let's wait for the conclusions to her inquiry while they're not supporting Johnson, but just following protocol. But I'm quite surprised there's only 20 letters gone into the 1922 committee thus far, given the extent of the breaches of lockdown. These MPs will be under huge pressure from their constituents. There are local elections coming up in May. This will be a very telling measure of the extent of public opinion in regards to Johnson. The list of his opinion polls has Labour 14 points ahead. I still think Boris Johnson carries some favour amongst, especially Red Wall, the North, the new working class base vis-a-vis Brexit. He's seen as more relatable, certainly, than Keir Starmer. Mm-hmm. He likes a drink, he likes a laugh. He's a guy who's prone to scandal. He's got a sense of humour. And that plays well with a lot of people in the country that, you know, who feel disconnected from the usual machine politicians such as Keir Starmer. My surprise is that Labour is not further ahead than 14 points, given the extent of these breaches of lockdown, especially, as you just touched upon with Farah Hughes, regarding the party that was held the night before the Queen attended her husband's funeral almost on her own and obeying lockdown rules. So we're yet to see what's going to happen next week. Sue Gray's conclusions, her report will be key in determining the fate of Boris Johnson. He's going to tough it out. Don't forget that Sue Gray is a Johnson appointee, as is Cressida Dick, the head of the Met Police. Sure. And there's a bit of harsh light shone on her for her inaction so far, willing to investigate previous breaches that have come to light with regards to Johnson and his administration.
Okay. We don't want this, and I'm trying not to make this a Boris Johnson bashing 25-minute block here, but we need to talk about his behavior, Farah Hughes, and I'm going to use the words of a Shoreham MP that I'm sure you're familiar with, Tim Loughton, who has said, the reason for my conclusion and calling for him to stand down is the way that this is handled, and he described it as, quote, obfuscation, prevarication, and evasion to have been the order of the day. Do you agree?
Yes, it's a very good description, and it's very apt, and it's very to the point. First, he denied the allegations. In fact, I think he denied them twice before eventually coming to the fore with the latest information put out into the public domain. He's admitted that he was there. What we're witnessing is Boris Johnson's, it's partly, I think, his personality. He's a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and somebody who'll just, like, you know, manipulate the truth in order to sell himself to both the public and the party. I feel that he's been caught out telling fibs. He's been caught out with his finger in the cookie jar, or perhaps the drinks cabinet in this particular instance. But I think he has told or been economical with the truth in the way he's handled it. So there's a bit of buffoonery there. There's a bit of he's admitted that he's made mistakes, but I don't think it's enough to make him go, because I don't think there's enough will within the Conservative Party to throw him under the bus. Mm-hmm. I do think there's an opportunity, if he can see this through, he'll be there until at least May, when they have the local elections. Sure. And see how he finishes after that.
Okay, well, on that, John White, what has Boris Johnson done? I mean, really, if you think about it, he's the one that perhaps gained his notoriety, in a sense, from Brexit, the deadlock that gripped the UK for so many years, if not the whole world, in a sense. So, but aside from that, can you tell us?
Well, nothing really. He's gained a lot of credit from Brexit. He's completely mishandled COVID in the UK. 150,000 COVID dead tells its own story. He was too slow to lock down, and when he did lock down, over two months after China locked down in January of 2020, he didn't lock down hard enough. He has known to have said that the bodies pile high when he was faced with the prospect of having to implement another lockdown. And so, you know, it's surprising to me that he hasn't been forced out of office up to now. The PPE scandals, the High Court in London just recently adjudged that his VIP lane, so-called, giving PPE contracts to Tory donors and so on the pretext of COVID, was illegal. So this is an administration, a government that's mired in scandal, illegality, lies, obfuscation, as you mentioned, and just being economical with the truth. There seems to be no lie that he won't tell, his ministers won't tell, in order to bolster their position. So the corruption is deep and it's unending. So, you know, he is a rogue prime minister, probably in a long line of such, and it's remarkable to me, as I say, that he's not being forced out of office. You know, I just think this reflects a debased political culture in the UK surrounding Brexit.
Sure. Well, on the line of what you said earlier, Frahus, I'm going to go with two viewer comments here. One, so our politicians lied to us. What a surprise. The real news here is that government officials never have taken the COVID threat seriously. The big question is, why should we? And the next viewer comment, I think it's shocking that Johnson may force subordinates to resign and not himself. The boss carries the responsibility. Boris Johnson is not the ideal PM, but if he resigns, I see no credible candidates to replace him. Should we look at Boris Johnson, the man, and separate him from the party, or are they both in this thing together?
Well, first of all, he's leading the party, and secondly, I mean, there was an invitation to perhaps, was it 100 people, to bring your own and have the party in the Downing Street gardens. And only 30 people turned up. That's telling in itself. That, you know, would imply that 70 people who were invited said to themselves, no, I don't think this maybe is a very good idea. Don't think it's maybe very appropriate under the circumstances with what else is happening with COVID regulations in the country. As I've said, Johnson's leading the party, so he has ultimate responsibility for whatever he does as an individual and also as the leader of the party. But he's got a huge majority. There aren't any elections, meaningful elections outside of the council elections until 2024. He's not going to resign. I mean, there's no way someone with that personality who's been able to get himself to the top of British politics is just going to fall on the sword. And he won't go in as he's pushed. And I can't see there being a groundswell of people within the Conservative Party looking rid of Boris Johnson at the moment. And I completely agree with John. I mean, we are just seeing the tip of the corruption iceberg that is British politics. And it's not just British politics. It's all the neoliberal governments across Europe and in America. They're up to their necks in graft, and they're paid for by corporations, and they treat the rest of us, especially the voters, with disdain. They only care about us once every 4 years when we go into the polling booth and put our X against someone's name. It isn't a name. Normally it's a party. And with the two-party system we have, are both moving further and further to the right. Working-class people in Britain will suffer for decades to come, regardless of whether or not Boris Johnson's in power this time next year.
Well, you know, when you take a look at what's happening in the world right now, John White, I mean, we're looking at Europe, in particular NATO and the U.S., and the way that they're confronting Russia. We're looking at our part of the world, where we get sanctioned every other day, practically, and other world events that shape the world in one shape or another in a major way. That we're looking at the U.K. and parties where you have to bring your own alcohol. So when you have... being the UK trait right now and how it's made headlines. Perhaps what I'm looking at here was a quote that was made by a particular MP that says, what we're seeing right now is the culture at 10 Downing Street that is necessary for it to change. What is this culture of 10 Downing Street that is requires a change in it, if you agree with that.
Well, it's like the dying days of Rome. We're seeing these parties in Downing Street with people, you know, procuring suitcases full of wine, cavorting in the Downing Street gardens, flouting lockdown rules and regulations at the same time as the morgues were filled up with COVID dead. NHF nurses and clinicians were at breaking point, suffering PTSD, dealing with the consequences of COVID. It's at the height of the pandemic in the UK. It's really redolent of the dying days of Rome. And Fran touched on something very important when he mentioned the word neoliberalism. This is a product of late capitalism. This is a demise of the West on a broader level. And these politicians like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are a product of those dying days. They are the corruption that a corrupt political system produced. And I see this as a very serious inflection point in global politics. The UK coming out of Brexit, that was a last gasp, a death rattle of British imperialism, thinking that resorting to nationalism, Union Jack flag waving, can deal with the problems wrought by neoliberalism in a time of crisis. The wrong lessons have been learned from the financial and economic crash of 2008, mm-hmm. and neoliberalism is a corpse, and it's a putrefying corpse that needs to be buried. Boris Johnson is not the man to bury that corpse, neither is Keir Starmer. So we're looking at the demise of the UK as a state, and I look forward to the day that it breaks up, because it's on the way of breaking up. It has no answers to the challenges of the 21st century, and Boris Johnson is a product of the same apparatus as Keir Starmer is. Nothing good can come of either of those two men in power for the UK to remain a unified state.
Sure. Well, I was going to talk about Keir Starmer, but I don't know after what John White said there, I should get into that. But I have to, because in regards to the ratings, where you have obviously Boris Johnson's ratings to plummeted, and we're looking at Labour actually to pretty much on the back of this gained 41% of the vote share based on one particular poll. I don't know if you're a fan of polls there. Frahis, this one by Opinium, putting Labour on 41% of the vote share, Conservatives at 31%. Is there a chance for Labour to come on? I mean, we're looking obviously at Keir Starmer at this point heading that party, but is he, as he says, perhaps somebody that could act in the public interest should he resign, in reference to Johnson?
I think in truth and in honesty, what we'll have is we have a two-party system, the same as they do in America and most of Western Europe. So what happens is when the incumbent government or the prime minister becomes a failure or is shown through his actions to be incompetent or uncaring, what we have is the pendulum that swings once upon a time from the conservative right wing to the Labour left wing. And then with Tony Blair, obviously he brought New Labour to central politics, and I would say that Starmer is a devotee of Tony Blair's politics. It's mm-hmm. funny that Margaret Thatcher's kind of best outcome was the election of Tony Blair. So I think what we have now, if you're looking at Starmer as someone who is a real challenge to Boris Johnson, I don't think he is. I think he's a complete lightweight. I think with the destruction and the destroying of the reputation of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a lot of people who are traditional Labour voters who will not vote sure. Labour under Keir Starmer. And I think what we have is we have a Tory-liked prospective uh-huh. Prime Minister in
okay.
waiting.
Let me jump in here quickly, because we're fresh out of time, and ask John White the last question. John White, you said how even the two parties here are not suffice to deal with what the UK has to deal with. And one of the issues that are at the top of the agenda for any country now is how to deal with COVID, how to make sure economic progress is going to be made, amongst all the other issues that are involved when it comes to the UK. So what are we looking at in terms of the UK's future here? How it's going to grow out of COVID when you have these scandals bringing down the current government, as it appears?
Well, COVID, in one sense, has been a political distraction from the problems surrounding Brexit, because all the new regulations that are going to come into force regarding Brexit come into force by the summer. So we're going to see real chaos at the ports. There's still the issue of Ireland and the border down the Irish Sea, and we've seen a push towards Irish unity, such as we haven't seen since partition in the early 1920s. We're seeing a huge upswing in support for Scottish independence. And all the while in England, they seem to be moving, turning more and more insular in terms of their politics, in terms of the culture wars that are being unleashed there by Brexit. It's unleashed, to my mind, the forces of racism. Britain is no longer a major power, but it's trying to masquerade as one, and it's always been able to do so under the umbrella of US hegemony. Uh-huh. But since coming out of the EU, the UK is now seen as an important ally to the US as it was hitherto. And so we're yet to see how this will play out in global terms. Johnson is an embarrassment. There are multiple crises that face Britain right now, including foreign policy, including economics, including Indeed. The fallout from COVID, including trade, etc., etc. So this is a distraction, and I think at some point, Tory MPs, backbenchers, will have to look at their own position with regards to their constituents.
Okay.
The election comes in 2024. On this trajectory, the Tories will lose their 80-seat majority, and we'll see Keir Starmer as the new Prime Minister.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. John White there. Thank you for your contribution, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator from Belfast. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From the Covert Tarvay entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and it's about his life and times and the impact this man made on not only the Muslim world, but the entire globe as a whole. Once again, I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And I'd like to bring in Dr. Mahdi Turabi, my good friend, on this subject. And I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much again. Dr. Mahdi Turabi, we spoke at length about, the impact that Imam Khomeini made, as you said, on a pretty materialistic, secular world in which religion was marginalized, and how Imam, by living Islam, made an enormous impact on reviving and putting religion back on the world map. But now we want to move on a bit more, because I remember, as you will as well, that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, the first thing I remember about him was his call for unity. And he would say that it is perfectly permissible to go to Sunni mosques and pray behind a Sunni prayer imam and so on and so forth. so that we could foster fraternity, unity, in the spirit that our holy prophet, peace be upon him, used to do right at the beginning and the outset of Islam, to bring brotherhood and genuine friendship amongst each other, so that this, with this unity, we would become powerful in this world. Your take on that, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's exactly as you said it, which is that, you know, the only ones that benefit from, you know, us fighting, Sunni Shia fighting, are the enemies of Islam.
Exactly.
So it's
exactly.
as simple as that.
It's as simple
there's
as
really
that.
Not,
yeah.
You know, it's not really that complicated.
No, it's not.
You know, the things that we have differences on, well, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, the majority of things we don't have differences on.
And the other thing was that we were asked...
You focus
yeah.
on that.
You
and
focus
you talk
on
about
that,
the
yes.
other things,
yeah.
and you do it in a peaceful way, and you do it
sure.
as you would with your brother, in the sense that you love each other, and you know, take care of each other, and you help each other.
Yes.
And the difference is you try to work out with each other.
Well, the
so
other
the
other thing
you know?
Was, Dr. Mahdi, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the other thing is that as far as what I remember, the message was that there was no need for a Shia to be a Sunni or a Sunni to be a Shia. The main thing was that we, you know, respect each other's beliefs, respect each other's points of view, but the main thing is that we are united in terms of our purpose in living Islam, you know, creating this Islamic civilization and, you know, presenting an alternative to the rest of the world that is sinking in social ills and, you know, and corruption and all kinds of deviance, which, you know, Islam purifies us from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And look at our history. I mean,
yeah.
you know, the reason that, you know, they were able to come and take over the Muslim world is because we were divided. I mean, it's simple.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult.
No, it's not. It's not
okay.
rocket science, as they say.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
Okay. When we were divided, they were united. They took over.
Exactly.
Wassalam.
Okay. Wassalam. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I could see that even now. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're still doing it.
Yeah.
And
still
the reason
doing
they
it.
like having Al Saud be the guardians of Mecca and Medina is because, and the Takfiris is because that's going
to
lead, you know,
to more division.
That helps them. That helps them. Control of the Muslim world.
Exactly.
And if you get rid of Al Saud and the Takfiris, that's it.
You've absolutely.
Got, you know, I mean, how much better would that be for the Muslims, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because this is the main source of contention at the moment, the main root cause of...
And remember, the Takfiris are not Sunni.
No, they're not. No, no.
The Takfiris are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No,
they're
no.
Takfiris.
They're enemies. They're actually the...
They're the enemies.
They're hypocrites
the ones,
that the Quran speaks
the
about.
They're the ones that are doing the bidding of the Zionists in America.
Exactly, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay, why are you so, you know, when are you going to get it?
Hmm. Absolutely.
I almost said it.
Because, I mean, it's in the words of Netanyahu himself. He says Saudi is the last line of defense for this illegitimate state of Israel.
I'm just saying, you know, to all Muslims, Sunni, Shia, young, old, you know, brothers
yeah.
and sisters.
Sure.
You know, it's so clear to everyone now what's going on.
Exactly.
You know, whatever, 30 years ago, whatever.
Mm.
Okay? Isn't it clear now who's with who gets money from who is, you know, giving money to cannibals and organ eaters and who is...
Yes, yes.
Yes,
Vladimir Putin, who said, yes, I'm not going to support organ eaters. I don't want my kidney to be cooked by a takfiri.
You know,
yeah.
You know, it's time to step up. And
exactly.
I'm talking, you know, mainly the Sunni brothers and sisters. You see the realities. Why are you still stuck? Why are you still worried about? What are you still, you know, why are you still confused?
Mm.
Why are you confused? Look at what happened to Ikhwan.
Yes.
They trusted. They went with the Saudis. They went with the Americans. They got burnt. This is mainly, you know, addressed to the Sunni brothers and sisters.
Yes, absolutely.
Look at what has happened in the last year.
Yes. Particularly in Egypt, yes.
Egypt, Turkey, and all those places where the so-called, you know...
Brotherhood.
The mainstream, moderate, the proper, you know, Islamic movements, the minute they align themselves with the Saudis and with the Israelis,